Hey everybody, Jeff Dunham and Walter. We just finished recording my podcast, so be sure to subscribe, like, and comment on my YouTube channel. And you can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. If you're already watching this video on YouTube or Facebook, be sure to click the link in the description to stream or download the audio version from Apple, Spotify, or the podcast service of your choice. And as for our merchandise, tour updates, and all things Jeff Dunham, be sure to visit my website, jeffdunham.com. How's that, Walter?
What the hell's a podcast?
Everybody, Jeff Dunham. Welcome to the third episode of the Jeff Dunham Podcast. And joining me today are Matt McNeil and Jeff Rothman to my right, if you're watching on video. How are you guys?
Good.
Good. How are you?
I'm great. You know what? Last time, our last episode, we chatted a lot, and I think we chatted too much.
Okay.
I do.
But we had a lot to say.
This is about exactly. This is about the guest. And last time we made it about us for the first 20 minutes before we got to Gabe, and people were like, when we premiered it on YouTube, Matt, people were like, funny, haha, get to Gabe, man, come on.
Oh, you gotta make him wait, come on.
Yeah, my manager,
I'm a bonus.
Exactly. And my manager pointed out to me, well, that's what they did on the Tonight Show. Both Carson and and Leno would do that. They do 30 or 40 minutes of stuff before they ever got to the guest.
Oh, right. Yeah, they would do the monologue, and then they would do a desk bit.
Right. And you go, I have to wait.
And had we not dragged it out, you never would have gotten your Christmas present. So.
That's right. Okay.
Yeah, that was worth the wait.
It was worth the wait. And Matt, I must tell you that that picture is still out in the foyer. We're trying to figure out exactly where to hang it. And I keep pointing one direction, and Audrey keeps pointing a different direction.
Yeah, the closet.
The closet.
Exactly. No, no. She keeps pointing to my office in here. All right. So our guest today is going to be Mr. Howie Mandel. And, it's tough when you try to introduce a guy like this. Because what are you going to do, run through his credits? I mean, he's had a career that anybody would want, right?
Oh, yeah. Like, he started as a stand-up comedian. He's done game show hosting, judging on the shows, like AGT and... I mean, yeah, where do you start? Where do you end?
Yeah, and like you mentioned a few minutes ago before we started, Jeff, is that so many people don't know that he was actually a stand-up comic long before he was doing AGT or Deal or No Deal or any of that.
Yeah, remember, exactly. He had that, like, that hand-shaped purse or something he would come out with. Like, he had a whole, like, character kind of persona built around him. It was a... I remember that young stand-up comedian special that he was first on.
Yeah,
that's right.
And he would do, the glove, put the glove over his head and inflate it. And you'll learn in the interview why he happened to have that glove. And I think people know why he just happened to have that glove. And also he explains in the interview when he does the, okay, you know, when he does that, that was his signature. That was his signature thing. And he explains where that came from. And it's really, really interesting. It was so organic to him and to his act.
Oh, cool. I never knew that. Knew why he did that. Because I just thought it was a thing he either came up with or I wonder if he even thought about it ahead of time. Okay, I'll be interested to see that.
Yeah. Well, you'll hear about it. You'll see it if you're watching. But it's pretty interesting though. But I mean, the guy's career has just been absolutely amazing. And he was never, he and I've had these other conversations where he was not a normal stand-up that went the typical route. I mean, most guys, when you talk about the United States, he's from Canada, where you go to LA or New York and you start doing clubs and you start working your way up like that. He didn't do it like that.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
And also, but just so you know, he apparently before COVID, I know he was still doing stand-up shows, I think in Vegas and different places. So he still toured around apparently. And I even had a chance to write jokes for him at the Montreal Comedy Festival. And I would send him jokes for weeks and weeks. And he would say, oh, this is great. Great stuff. Thank you so much. And then he'd go up on stage and not use one joke. He made up everything off the top of his head.
So he's also a really kind guy too.
Yeah, I worked for nothing for months. I mean, I didn't care if he wanted to do improvisation the whole time, but anyway, it all went out the window. But he still did great without any writing.
So you're saying that some of your first experiences with Howie Mandel, Jeff, is that he hurt your feelings?
Yeah, he hurt me deeply. I was more upset that I actually had to do a lot of work, and he kept saying how great it was. And I was telling everybody how he loves my stuff, and then he went up on stage and did not one word.
That's really funny.
But he was very funny, and he can just improvise the whole hour or whatever it was.
Yeah. Well, he's nuts too, but I had a fun time with him. So, all right, folks, we'll get to the interview now. So here we go. My guest today, I have been looking forward to this, you don't know how much. This guy is so much fun. He has contributed to all sorts of show business in the world. He makes us laugh. He entertains us. He has overcome obstacles, personal obstacles. But most of all, he is just a heck of a fun guy and entertaining. And the accomplishments are the list is so long. He needs no introduction, ladies and gentlemen. Please welcome Mr. Howie Mandel. Howie, welcome. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. I do need an introduction, but that was good enough. That was good enough.
I hate it when people say that he needs no introduction. It's like it's annoying as hell. But thank you so much for coming in and doing this with me today.
Well, my pleasure, buddy. You're a good friend. I love you. I'm a big fan of yours. I've been before I even knew you, and before we became friends, I was following your career. You were on my talk show.
Yeah, I know. I was gonna go to that clip, but I'm embarrassed for myself.
Why? It was with Walter, right?
Yeah, it was with Walter. Yeah, who knows? But look, I just want to say we don't live too far from each other, and no. It's a little bit trite to ask people how are you doing now, and but I am curious. I know you've been going nuts with TikTok, but You out of everybody, I think, needs to stay busy. Am I correct with that assumption?
Well, I need to be distracted and always have been. And I've been very open about my mental health struggles, throughout my whole life. And I've been open about being, depression and anxiety and OCD and ADHD, almost every letter. I'd like to buy a vowel. So this is really tough. And, we call each other and talk to each other. And I'm talking about just generally with friends, and everybody goes, how you doing? And, nobody's doing fantastic.
Right.
No, maybe Amazon. Maybe if you call Jeff Bezos, Amazon's doing fantastic. But beyond that, this is really difficult for everybody. And we all have and need and are kind of engaged in our own kind of coping skill. And whether that coping skill is finding ways to stay busy, finding ways to entertain, dancing in 15-second increments on TikTok, or, doing a podcast, whatever it takes to just move us along in kind of a positive way, I'm here for it.
Well, I was obviously I try and do a little research before I talk to somebody, and you mentioned the mental illness, and I didn't want to go there at first. I was going to talk about some fun stuff, but I must tell you, when I went through, it started with the Wikipedia thing, and I have to tell you, I was moved because some of the incidents that it goes through and talks about, you make fun of it yourself. And I know Brian Regan makes fun of it a little bit with himself. And somebody who doesn't have it or have anything like that, we tend not to understand, and we understand the jokes better. But I was really moved by what you've had to deal with and how you deal with it, and how sometimes on camera, like on AGT, everybody thinks it's a big joke, but I think you can see you and see that it's really not. And I'm so moved by how you have handled that. And are you comfortable with the way that you have to handle it on camera like that? Are those horrible moments, or do you look back and go, okay, I'm going to pat myself on the back for what I did there?
I don't externally think about it that much, how I'm handling something, but the truth of the matter is, first of all, humor, and I think you'll agree with this, humor always, a real sense of humor comes from a dark place. It's never a happy, smooth place to be. I mean, even as a child, when you go to the circus and you laugh at a clown falling down, you're really laughing at the misfortune of somebody else, you know? Or if two guys walk into a bar, you know, it's not a joke unless something embarrassing happens to one of them or is said to one of them. So to that end, you know, I think there is nobody alive that, you know, it's just a human condition to have mental health issues. It doesn't have to be illness. It's just issues with your mental health. It's like some people have bad backs. Some people have bad knees. Some people go to the dentist a lot and they have a lot of tooth decay and gum problems. Equally, I always say, I wish we it was part of our curriculum to take care of our mental health the way we take care of our dental health. But truth be told, I found comedy by accident, and laughter has always been my panacea. You know, when I'm feeling my worst, if I could try to cheer myself up or act silly or make a joke about it, that kind of got me through. And I had no idea and didn't aspire to be a comedian. I didn't have a lot of friends as a kid. I always looked to you and I was thinking, well, I do know a little bit about you, and we've talked about personal issues, but you had the ability to make your own friends,
right?
You know, whether you manufactured them and put them on your hand and talk to them. But, you know, the truth is that a lot of people in their career is kind of a, the crutch that gets you through life, you know, and whether you don't have interest in what most people have interest in and you don't kind of connect, if you could just focus on yourself and find these things, you know, my only form of communication with outside of my, you know, my parents was, and I found this out the hard way or maybe the easy way on a dare to get up on stage in 1977. And April 19th, 1977, I just went to a comedy club with a couple of people because I didn't like, I'm not a dancer and I'm not a drinker. Disco was all the rage. I'm not a sports guy, you know, so I didn't get together with friends and play basketball once a week. I'm not a gambler, so I didn't have a poker game to go to. So we went to this comedy club, which was, this was the beginning of the boom in the mid 70s. And it was kind of fun. And the host, I'm from Toronto, Canada, the host of the club said, you know, if you're an amateur and you want to try this out after midnight on Mondays, you can come up and do 5 minutes or 3 minutes. I can't remember what it was. And somebody at the table went, you should go. And I went, oh, yeah, okay. And part of my ADHD is acting impulsively without even thinking of the ramifications, which I believe is a good everybody should try this. I think we get in our own ways too much. We overthink things. I think, you know, Nike is right when they say just do it. But my idea was to just get on stage. You know, they said, you should get up. And I said, okay, thinking without any preparation, the funny thing will be that the Mark Breslin, who was the host of Yuck Yucks at the time, will say, ladies and gentlemen, Howie Mandel, and Howie Mandel will come on stage. I'll come on stage. And that's the joke, because I'm not a comedian and I don't have an act.
Right.
But my friends will be there. A couple of friends will be there and it'll just be funny. I didn't think it through. And what happened was they went, ladies and gentlemen, Howie Mandel. And I walked out and, you know, you got the traditional smattering of applause. Nobody even knows who I am. And I walk out there. And as you know, as being a performer, you know, I'm blinded by the light of the you know, it's a small club, 150 people. I'm blinded by the spotlight. But I look down in front. You can see the front rows. And there's two rows of strange faces. These weren't my friends. Of people that are looking up at me going, well, right. do something, funny boy. Right. And then I got terrified. You know, horrified. You know, it was like that dream when you show up at a party and you realize you're naked. You know, so and then if you look at my old, if you look at my old videos, I realized, okay, so the joke, my joke personally didn't go over. I got to come up with something. So let me think really fast on my feet. I start going, okay, I'm going to think of, and that was just horror. Right. And they started giggling at me being horrified. And I started getting laughter at my, okay. And I didn't know. And I felt like, what, are my pants split? Is there something going on? And I started asking them, what? No, tell me what? And then even like, and then they weren't saying anything. And I would say things like, oh, please don't laugh. It's throwing me off. You know, please, from a comedy stage, I'm saying, please don't laugh. It's throwing me off. And then, as you've alluded to, you know, I have OCD and all these things, and I had it way back then, and I was carrying latex gloves for fear of maybe having to enter a public restroom. I put my hands in my pocket, and I grabbed there was a rubber glove, and I had nothing to do. And I just, for whatever reason, no thought and no preparation, I pulled it over my head and my nose, and I started breathing. The fingers were going up and down, and the audience was just roaring. And so I inflated it with my nose. I blew it out and popped off my head. The audience roared, and I went, good night. And I walked off stage, and Mark was there. He goes, you got to come back tomorrow. I said, for what? He goes, do it again. And I said, do what? He said, what you did. And what I realized was, in that moment of terror was the first time I was very cognizant of being in the now. So anything that I worry about in life, in that moment when I was terrified about maybe hopefully coming up with something amusing and entertaining these strangers, in that moment, I wasn't worried about getting sick. I wasn't worried about germs. I did something, whether I understood what exactly it was that I was doing, was eliciting laughter from other people. So it was my first form of real communication and engaging with strangers. And I didn't aspire to be a comedian. I didn't aspire to be in show business. If I could, and I'm honest with you now, if I could like once or twice a week, you know, just walk into a club, I don't give a shit if I'm a waiter, you know, a stock boy or whatever. If I had that twice a week, I promise you that is the panacea and my need. You know, the fact that I've had some success is, you know, I chalk up to luck, but I need to do this. In fact, it's more apparent now than it has ever been. It's since April 19th, 1977, up until 1 year ago this week that we're talking, I think the longest stretch of time, and it might've been because I was sick or something, or had, you know, was on location where there wasn't something, maybe 2 weeks, maybe three would be a stretch to say that 3 weeks I was the longest time that I had never been on stage in front of strangers.
Isn't that funny? Yeah, I said the same thing because I, you know, started doing book reports in the third grade, and I got, you know, birthday parties, and it was the same way. I'd never gone more. I went for 1 month when Audrey and I got married for our honeymoon, but up to that, never more than 2 weeks off stage. And it has not been easy. And people who are on stage, who are not on stage, they don't understand that.
Well, they don't. And, you know, I don't know if you feel the same way, but I didn't realize until this pandemic that it wasn't only fun, and it is a necessity for me. And that is my connection. And just like people have to go, and I do too, you know, I got to go talk to my therapist. I need that. And that is my lifeline. I realize that that live audience is my lifeline, regardless of anything you see me do, whether I'm hosting, you know, judging on AGT or hosting Deal or No Deal or doing Bobby's World. The one solid thing that I've constantly done is stand up. I didn't know how much I needed it until it's gone, you know, and right now it's gone. And that's probably one of the hardest things. That's the thing that's impeding my happiness the most, is the inability to be in front of live people.
You know, you probably handled it a much healthier way than I did. And I, you know, the first month or two, I was like a little bit, I always, in, you know, when the lights would go out and when the electricity would go out when I was a kid, I thought it was the greatest thing ever. Those things that were unusual and you couldn't control, there was an excitement to it. So for the first month or two, for me, this was kind of exciting, because not exciting, but it was just, it was different. It was like, let me take the word exciting away. It was a little bit stimulating, because I thought, we're going to get through this. This is a new adventure in life. And then so many people started getting sick and dying. And then it wasn't entertaining anymore. It wasn't, you know, I thought we're, you know, the 2 week turnaround and then everything's going to be fine. And it wasn't. Right. And that you handled it better than I did, because I went through a depression that my wife and I are almost convinced that we had COVID in this house, because it was almost debilitating. I don't know what's wrong with me. Why am I feeling like this? and you know, you're going to therapy. Maybe I should have gone to therapy or something. But I
well, you're saying I'm handling it different than you. You're just saying that because of this 5 minutes of conversation that we started with. And no, I wasn't. This has been horribly debilitating. There's days when I can't even function, when I can't get out of bed. There's days where, you know, and even at this point, you know, I'm driving my wife crazy. I don't know. Honestly, I don't know if I'm funny anymore. I walk around the house and I write things or have ideas, and I'm driving my wife crazy going, do you think this is funny? Do you think this is a good premise?
Well,
do you
think this is good? I got to tell you, Audrey and I were going through the TikToks and it's like, these are funny as hell. What's wrong with this guy?
You know? Right. But people say, what's wrong? You know, and I read that, what's wrong? And I don't know if it's funny, and you can't connect. You know, there's nothing that is more informative at the moment than a live audience. And in so many ways, you know, there is something about if you project what you think is, you know, humor is raw. Humor to me is at the heart of who we are. You know, if you could define somebody's humor, like what will make somebody smile or what makes you laugh, that kind of makes, for me, that makes you know somebody even more. And it's not that you have to get a laugh. You know, as we are two people that travel the world sometimes, or at least the country, do you know, selling our wares. There are certain things that play in certain parts of the country differently than another part of the country. You know, the same joke or the same piece the next night doesn't have the exact same reaction. And that keeps me in tune with these people are different than these people. This is what these people respond to. This is what these people are sensitive about. This is what, and to me, that's a connection to humanity. Just kind of knowing, you know, even learning what they don't laugh at.
Well,
you know?
that brings up the other question, and it, with this cancel culture and all that's going on, and now even when I ask this question and bring up this subject, it's dangerous to even talk about it.
It is, you know, and it's so scary. You know, the truth of the matter is, you know, I came out here, as I explained to you earlier, you know, I didn't really, my act was no act. And it was, you know, I was a fan of a lot of comedians, and I came out here in the early 70s and I watched Richard Pryor on stage putting together every night. He'd show up at the Comedy Store cobbling together what became the Live on the Sunset Strip, which I think is one of the most seminal, you know, concert films ever. I think that's what inspired Eddie Murphy and Dave Chappelle and others after him. And it inspired me. And what inspired me was the ability, when he was putting it together, you know, number one, he was incredibly brave. It was the first time I watched comedians, you know, up until that time, aside from me and showing up at Yuck Yucks, you know, my taste of comedy was from The Tonight Show, The Ed Sullivan Show, everybody, Merv Griffin. But every time you saw people, they were incredibly slick. You know, they had their act and they had, but what went into that? And that's what the Comedy Store was, where you could show up and try things out. And it was the first time I saw like a hero of mine, a comedy hero, trying things out. And I was also aware of his content, even though it was funny, was based in authenticity, which meant that he talked about his life and whether they were, you know, he was doing a funny character that was a drug addict that he knew. He was raised by his grandmother in a brothel. He was addicted to drugs. He had just gotten out of the hospital when he started putting together this concert from, he was burned from freebasing. You know, and I became cognizant of this is all real stuff. And even though I'm laughing at it, there's a thin line. You look at those two masks of theater, you know, tragedy and comedy.
Sure.
There's a thin line between those two. You know, they're both just smiles. One's upside down, right. You know, and it became aware that I had to be, that it was kind of therapeutic to at least be real. And whether you think, and you watched my young comedian special and you watch this crazy, you know, over caffeinated kid who was just terrified, I think the reason that it kind of resonated with people who just knew me, they didn't even know a joke or anything, they would just go, what, you're the what guy, or with the rubber glove on your head, is because unbeknownst to me, it was authentic. You know, I was really terrified. I wasn't putting on an act. That was me. And I think that people connect when you can be you know, even I, your sensibility. I think one of the reasons you're so successful is, and having met you, is sometimes you know the thoughts that are coming out of all your characters are really yours,
right?
You know, and it's a way of communicating. And I think without communication, and comedy is a great form of communication, I think when we get cut off, we're all, and that's what this pandemic has done, we're all going a little crazy. And you can't tell me, if anybody's saying that they're doing fine and it's not affecting them, I think that they're just liars.
Yeah, and you can look at people and say everybody's aged just a little bit. But I go to that other, where I started to talk about the cancel culture. I don't know what this is going to be doing to comedy. The pandemic's going to go away and it'll be in the rearview mirror. But this temperature right now of not being able to talk about so much that we used to joke about all the time. There used to be that sanctity of the room, of the comedy club or the theater.
It wasn't even the comedy club. It was the sanctity of comedy. You know, the thing was, when we were coming up, even as young kids, if you say something that was offensive, somewhat offensive to anybody, you knew that you could get away with it if you went, no, I was just joking.
Right.
Oh, I thought you were serious. You know, under the confines of what was considered a joke, and obviously in a comedy club, everything is considered a joke, it was okay. And that's where I was going. I watched Richard Pryor pushing all the envelopes, and I kind of loved the freedom and the art form of what we were doing. And even we needed to have those places, and I use stage, not just a comedy store, to kind of find what that line is and maybe step over it and
sure.
learn that that's too. But nowadays, with the advent of technology, the fact that everybody's at a show with a phone and they can record you, something that you say or working on could be taken out of context,
right.
You know, and it's not the reality, it's the perception. And the social media can take things and you could be canceled tomorrow. And that is the scariest thing now with everything I do. It's scary to press send when you're making, when you're inputting anything into Twitter or whatever. I don't know how it's going to be taken. It's scary to even have this conversation with you because, yep. You know, up until this point, I don't feel like I've said something, but I will get off this call and go, did I say something that could be taken totally the wrong way?
Sure.
You know, but it's really scary. It started years ago before this cancel culture. I found it in the colleges. I remember Jerry Seinfeld talking about it. You know, I would go to college, you know, colleges when we were starting out was the young kind of open free space where you'd have the best sets. I would love these college gigs. I did the Gator Growl, you know, 80,000 people at their homecoming. And that was in the 80s. And then in the late 90s and the early 2000s, when you started doing colleges, they became the first people that were politically correct.
Right.
You know, don't refer to a woman in that way. Don't refer. And I got it, but it just became really hard to navigate that because they became so almost verbal about, you know, their dislike for political incorrectness. So much so that, you know, somebody like Bill Maher made a show called Politically Incorrect because
sure.
that was what was happening in the 90s. And I think that now that pendulum has swung so far where I don't know what political correctness is besides silence.
Well,
you know?
And then the next question would be, well, where is this all heading? How's it going to end? I mean, the fact that, you know, Pepe Le Pew is going away. And again, I can't say whether that's good or bad, because if I say that, then you're judged and your career is over with in a soundbite. So
that's exactly right.
And, right.
You know, but that was shocking to me. You know, I'm
right.
a big Pepe Le Pew fan.
I'm
a fan of rape, people. I'm not a fan of rape.
Now we're going to have to cut that out of the interview.
You
know, there's the
headline. I said
there's...
I'm not a fan of rape.
Yeah, but you said you're
Pepe Le Pew was funny.
Yeah, but you said you're a fan of Pepe Le Pew. That's all they would take. That's it. You know what I mean? That's all
right.
they would take from it. So that's what's so ridiculous about all this. You can't explain yourself because one of those sentences will be used to end you in your explanation. That's
but think of the ratings your podcast is going to have. You remember Howie Mandel? He was canceled on Jeff Dunham's podcast. What he said about Pepe Le Pew?
He worked so hard, and then he ended it with the puppet guy.
Yes.
Nice. Well, you know, let me ask you something else. So you and Terry have, and please forgive me if this is a trite question, but you and Terry have been married for 42 years now, 41, something like that?
41 this week.
This week. Oh, that's okay. So you're not normal. That doesn't happen in Hollywood, especially somebody as successful as you. And again, I apologize for this question, but what in the world? How does that happen? What makes you guys different than the typical couple around here?
I'll tell you exactly what makes us different, and it's harder now. What makes us different is I, like you, Jeff, had a job where I was never around. And that's when she loved me the most. This past year has been put a lot of pressure. We had our 40th anniversary in lockdown, and I wasn't sure we were going to make it to 41. I said to her this week, do you want to redo our vows? Her vow was enough already. And spending this kind of time together, and for her, I love her, and she's perfect and wonderful. I'm not going to get canceled out of this marriage on this podcast. I'll lose my career. I don't want to lose my wife. I'm sure she's had it up to here with me.
But let me ask you, honestly, though. I mean, a couple that stays together like you guys, I mean, do you go to bed laughing? Do you wake up laughing? Are you still overjoyed when you see her? I've seen you in the videos and the TikToks, and there's a bond there. There's a warmth. You guys aren't putting up with each other. That's not it.
No, you know, ultimately it's really the sense of humor, and that's what I enjoy in my friendships, in my wife, in my children. A sense of humor is always important to me, and a sense of humor for and it's my definition of a sense of humor. You know, a sense of humor is that sense of finding, you know, as I said earlier, you know, comedy always comes from a dark place, and in the real world of comedy there's no such thing as too soon. And in those moments that are the darkest and hardest moments of my life and all our lives is when, at least the people closest to me, is when we laugh the most. And basically out of survival, you know, the hardest day of my life was burying my father up until now. And I never laughed harder and more guttural. No, because the shit that was happening and finding the humor in those moments is the sensibility. You don't have a good sense of, in my mind, just because somebody comes up to you and says, you want to hear a joke? And you go, yeah. And then they tell you a joke and you laugh at it, doesn't mean you have a good sense of humor. I think a good sense of humor, and we all have to find that, is when you can laugh at your own misfortune, and you can laugh in your darkest moments, and you can, and there isn't too soon. You just have to find the humor in that moment, and that's what gets me through. And I always say, if I wasn't laughing, I'd be crying, and if I wasn't laughing, I'd be dying, you know. And that's the truth. On my hardest moments, there's always something weird and funny, which can also be construed by another person in the same room watching the exact same thing, can also be construed as tragedy.
Right. Did you speak at your father's funeral?
I couldn't. I was so devastated. Right. I couldn't talk.
Well, I'm an only child, and I was the only one I thought qualified to speak at my father's funeral. And I said, this is my dad, and I'm going to be the one to talk. And it was amazing because I got big laughs telling these jokes through tears.
Well, that's exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
And that's cathartic, mm-hmm. You know? And that's like, at those moments, people don't realize, you know, under the guise of laughter and silliness, you know, people write that off, you know, as, you know, there's much more thought given or praise given to anything that they see that is incredibly dramatic. And I think drama is kind of easy. You know, I was on I'm not knocking anybody who's an actor and does drama, but comedy is not easy. And to kind of find those moments and through the tears, make a group of people that are experiencing the greatest loss in the world make somebody laugh. And to elicit laughter, I always say that even on AGT, you know, I can't tell you how many times on stage I wished I was a musician, because, you know, if you're just playing your guitar and you're singing a song, people are sitting there. You don't need to hear the amount of feedback. Like a comedian needs, if every 30 seconds there's silence, it is obvious to everybody in the room that this is not going well.
Right.
And it's hard to get somebody to laugh. It's hard to get somebody to make a noise. It's hard. It's not hard at the end of the song to do that. Woo, woo, right. You know, but to get somebody to go, especially when they show up at a funeral, especially when you're feeling the greatest loss in the world, that is really, as much as it's really difficult to kind of capture, it's probably the most cathartic. I would imagine, I'm not a scientist or a doctor, I would imagine that it's probably incredibly healthy to, at those times, get those kind of endorphins released. It's my safety net, laughter. I would fall into a hole, a black hole that I would not be able to climb out of if it weren't for laughter. Laughter to me is what I, you know, what holds me up.
Well, then I would bet that, you know, like I said, I looked through your credits and it was just, it almost put me to sleep because it was so long. It was unbelievable, all the things that you've done with your career. And by the way, when I look at you and 65 years old, I'm like, but that's not possible. But my question is, and I think I know the answer to this, but is there any moment in all these years of performing that you finally went, okay, that's it, I've made it? Or are you still like the typical comic going, somebody's going to figure this out and figure out that this has all been a mistake?
Well, that is a constant, I think, in everybody's mind. But that being said, and I think you'll back me up on this, you know, it's always a struggle. There isn't a time, you know, people ask that question a lot. When do you know you made it?
Right.
But, you know, making it is not, in fact, the more work you do, the more whatever you're calling success you have, the harder the blows are and the rejection is. And I don't think a week goes by or even a few days go by when something that I want to do is turned down, where something that I have done fails. And it's constant, but you have to act, you know, I think of life as a 65-year-old now like a game. And this is a game you want to play. And regardless of whatever game you pick to play in life, it's always going to, like, you're always going to be, if you take the analogy of a game, you know, you're going to get hit, right? But if you're going to play the game and you love the game, you got to get up and keep playing if you want to try to win or you want to try to continue to compete. You're going to get sweaty. You're going to get out of breath. You're going to get hurt. But you're out, it's a Saturday, and you're playing a game. And all that, if you come in with a bruise, and you come in with a cut, and you come in out of breath, and you come in a mess, you go, oh, that was a great game. For some reason, people don't look at life the same way, but that's what life is. Life is a game. You play it. And whether you're playing a giant game of Monopoly, or you're playing a game where you just want to get people's attention, then you want to figure out how this game works, and you're going to keep pivoting and doing different things. Like here you are doing a podcast, and you're actually doing all the speaking yourself through your own mouth. You know, that's a pivot, and that's a game. And we can get discouraged. You know, I say to people, if you're going to go into boxing, the people who go into boxing, that's their passion. But you're going to get hit. You're going to get bruised. But you got the stamina to get up. And that's how life is. And I feel like I'm knocked down every day. But I wouldn't be knocked down if I wasn't playing. So the good news is I'm playing.
So has there ever been one of those moments, though, that you went, early on, was there ever one of those moments where you thought, maybe not even early on, maybe in the middle, where you went, I don't know if this is going to work out anymore, or I don't know if this is going to work
at
all?
Yeah, the truth of the matter, in 2005 was right before I started doing Deal or No Deal. And in 2005, ticket sales had waned for me. You know, I was doing a lot of HBO and Showtime special and cable specials in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And it carried me right to, and it catapulted me when I started to playing arenas and, big houses and the sheds and everything, and two shows a night with 10,000 people in each in the 80s.
And that was those tickets were all sold because of the Showtime and HBO specials, right? Is that what you're saying?
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And then around 2005, I was barely filling comedy clubs. I was sitting on fold-out card chairs outside of casting offices, auditioning for Five Lines and Under, and I'd be there in the – I didn't recognize anybody else that was doing that. And I had done a series in the 80s. I had done St. Elsewhere. I started out with, right. So I'm not an idiot, and I had saved some money, and I'm involved in real estate, as you know. And I said to my wife, it's not worth it anymore. I'm not getting the same joy. People aren't showing up. I could go, I wasn't going to, I said, whatever I do, I'll do in real estate, but I'm going to retire. And then maybe sometimes I'll drop in at the Comedy Store, the Comedy Magic Club, or the Laugh Factory if I feel like I want to do a set and get in front of people. But I don't want to pursue this anymore. And lo and behold, right at that same week, I got a call from my manager. I got a call from Michael, and he said, NBC wants you to host a game show. And I went, you. And I hung up the phone, because you have to, let's put this into perspective. In 2005, there were no comedians, nobody from the world of comedy doing game shows. And in fact, when your currency is irony and comedy, the game show host was probably the punchline at the time. Though, I respect them, but it wasn't something comedians were going to do. It would [S2] Right. [S1] Be something they would be laughed at. So the fact that at the same time as I'm saying I'm out of here, he's calling me with an offer that would definitely put the nail in the coffin of my career.
Right.
And then Michael calls me back an hour later and he goes, don't say fuck you. Listen, this is the biggest game show in the world, apparently. And NBC, no other network, and no network has ever done this before. They're going to devote five straight nights of primetime TV to this show. And I went, well, even more of a reason to fuck you. Like, you want to put an end to my career? They want to do this in the biggest way possible. 5 hours on network TV seeing me do this shit. No way. He called me back. Luckily, he called me back one more time. He goes, listen, they're bothering me. They say they can't do it without you. You're perfect for this show. It's big all over the world except America. Will you just look at the game? And I said, Michael, I'll be honest with you. I don't feel like going in. I don't want to audition. I don't want to... No, you don't have to audition. They think you're perfect for it. Can he just show you the game? I said, I'm sitting in Jerry's Deli in the Valley. I'm having some soup. If the guy wants to come to the Valley and talk to me personally, I'm not going anywhere. He can come to me. And he goes, okay, I'll call you back. And then he said, the guy's coming. Rob Smith from Endemol shows up at Jerry's Deli, moves my soup. And this is like, I thought I was being punked.
Jerry's Deli, the one on Ventura, right?
Yep.
Okay.
And he has, and I have this in my office, the picture. He brought a card. He made a project of making the game. But it's not like he even went to Kinko's. It looks like a 7-year-old bad student project.
Wait, he made the little suitcases?
He made little cards, little squares that had amounts on it. $750 that he drew himself. And then he had an art card that had the 26 squares. And he moves my soup and he puts down all the cards and he goes, pick a card. Don't look at the amount of money that's written on it and put it aside. He goes, do you think you got the one that I wrote a million on? I go, I don't know. All I know is I have some soup and let's play the game. And he goes, you know how we're going to find out if you have the million on your card? You're going to start opening these. And it was so bad. Remember, this is me with soup. There's no models. There's no cases. And then I thought it was a joke at the end. I go, there's no trivia. There's no skill. There's no nothing. He goes, we can't do this. We can't do this without you. And I go, okay, I'm going to go home now. I was like scared. I go home and I tell my wife. And she goes, Howie, this is why I know this harkens back to your question earlier about the pandemic and how it's affecting our relationship. She goes, take the effing job. And I go, well, but it's nothing. She goes, I don't care. I got to get you out of the house. Take the job. Just do it. And she's the one that made me do it. It's the first time I said no to something. I say yes to everything. It's the first time I said no. So this is a Friday. I called him and I called Rob and I said, I'll do it. And they went, wow, we couldn't do this without you. Thank you. And it's a Friday. And then I said, well, when does this tape? And he goes, Monday. And I go, Monday? well, don't you need to build a set? He goes, it's built. I said, don't you need to hire 26 models? They're there. And then I'm thinking, how far down the rung am I? How many people have said no, that there's a set, every model is done, it's 3 days away from taping. So everybody in town has said no to this.
Is that true? Did you find a list? Was there a list or was it just you?
It couldn't have been just me. I know one of the people. I know that Ellen was asked and she said no. You know, there had to be. There's no way. I'm a producer now. I know there's no way you're going to build a multi-million dollar set and put this on the network and on Friday night not have somebody for a Monday morning taping without having asked.
You ought to make a list and then you ought to make a list, a fake list, and leak it.
Yeah. And then what was funny is I said, okay, so you know what? I'm a comedian. I've been doing this all my life. I'm an actor. I said to them, I'm showing up Monday, but here's my caveat. Can I hire some of my friends, comedians, to write for me and to figure out? And they went, yeah. So over the weekend I had, and we used to watch, the only reference I had was You Bet Your Life with Groucho Marx. Sure. That was the only time I ever saw a comedian do a game show. Before that, I don't know of any comedians that hosted game shows.
Right.
So they started, and there was, you know, and I said, how do I spend an hour saying, pick a case, open a case, pick a case, open a case, pick a case, open a case. I go, there's got to be more to this game than that. So we wrote all this great humor, you know, all these great jokes. And I thought, okay, so if nothing else, you know, I haven't done a cable special in years. I'm going to be on primetime TV 5 nights a week. Even if this game is shit, I'm going to be so funny. And I'm going to restart my career. And what happened was, and I'll never forget, we did 500 episodes. And the first woman comes out, I introduce her, Karen Van. And I talk to Karen, and Karen has, you know, 3 children. She's a single mother. She's never had health insurance. She's never owned a home. And this is real. And she's got a glaze over her, like somebody who isn't in our business, standing on a set with, 300 people and all these lights. And then more importantly, I said, oh, my God, this is serious. I mean, her life is going to change. I may get a couple of jokes off, but her life is going to change. She's not paying attention. Right. And that's why I even changed my cadence when I started getting offers from the banker. I went, listen, Karen, the offer is $20,000. I couldn't have said it more staccato and slowly, so much so that right. The Saturday Night Live was making fun of my Caden when the show became big, because right. All I wanted, you know, first and foremost, I'm a human being,
right.
You know, and I'm a father and I'm a husband, and empathy kind of outrode any desire to kind of showcase myself.
Sure.
And I just wanted her and everybody else to leave in a better state than when they showed up. And I felt like if I wanted to do, I'm constantly asked to be a celebrity guest on game shows. And I'm so afraid that my silliness will be distracting to somebody, so much so that they make a wrong choice or right. They answer something wrong. And I would kill myself if I thought that I was responsible for somebody not making the best decision. So I threw all the comedy by the wayside. I threw everything by the wayside. And it just became about making Karen make a good decision. And that's how it, you know, and I shot all 5 shows with all the contestants. I was so embarrassed. I said, Terry, you've helped destroy my life, my wife. You know, this is the most embarrassing thing. This is the first time I was on TV. I had no jokes. I had no lines to recite. It was just as boring as I am on the couch at home. We got to get on a plane and I got to fly to someplace where there aren't any TVs. I don't want to be here for the fallout of this show. And we flew to Tortola in the Caribbean.
You actually left before it premiered.
Absolutely. I was so embarrassed. I didn't know how we would. I was devastated by what I had done. And I was in Tortola. And after that Monday night, that guy, Rob Smith, who came and had soup with me, calls me Tuesday morning. The phone rings and I could see on my phone it's him. And I'm going, oh, shit. I don't even want to get phone calls. I'm not watching on TV. I answer the phone. He goes, through the roof. I go, what? He goes, through the roof. I go, what does that mean? He goes, the ratings went through the roof. And I went, are you kidding me? They like this? And he goes, yeah. And then the next morning, I was still in Tortola. He calls me Wednesday. He goes, bigger. And the next morning, bigger. And the next morning, even bigger. All the way to Friday. And at the end of the week, 100 million people had watched the show. And this one thing that I was so afraid to do and resisted became the biggest success of my career. You know, up until then, I had my fans who knew me from comedy. I had fans who watched St. Elsewhere, but the same people who watched St. Elsewhere weren't the fans of my stand-up. You know, I would get letters at that time. There was no internet. Every week saying, I have a bet with my husband that you're not the idiot that pulls the rubber glove on your head. You know, the guy from... And then Saturday morning when I started doing Bobby's World, that's a different audience altogether. Deal or No Deal is the first show that brought all those, or people started realizing I was the same guy. I was the same guy that was Fiscus on St. Elsewhere. I was the same guy that was pulling the rubber glove on my head. I was the same guy that was doing Saturday morning cartoons. And that was the biggest example. And it was the one thing I was most afraid of in my life of doing, you know, career-wise.
But, you know, Harry, I think what comes through, much like Carson with you, is that there's a warmth. And I think so many people that are in the spotlight don't have that thing. They talk about that thing on stage or that thing in show business that makes them. But I also think there's another thing, and that's the warmth that comes through. And the fact that you didn't do jokes... And the fact that you cared about these people and you weren't an asshole backstage or off camera or on camera, I think that's what resonates with people and why you've been popular for so long and doing so well, and especially on AGT. And when it comes to AGT, I am, you know, when I watch those, I'm not a big TV watcher, but obviously I watch things now and then. And the best example, one of the best examples to me was Courtney Hadwin.
Oh, I love that. Oh, yeah, my gosh.
Yeah. And it's that moment was amazing. And you gave her the golden buzzer. And I just, you know, I've talked to you before. I've joked with you that I would love to be a judge on that show because I think I could be really good at it because
I think you would be. I'm going to put you back to work this month. I'm going to put your name.
I'm not doing this as a commercial, but the reason I say that is because I have been, as you have been, every place, every one of those contestants has been. You've succeeded, right. You've failed, you've had pain, you've had joy, all that stuff. But I think what comes through with you and the reason you're the longest lasting judge on that show is because of the warmth. And I'm going to guess, I'm this guy that I can't, my emotions get a hold of me and I don't, you know, I choked up talking about my father just a second ago. So right. I think that's what comes through in TV with you is that you are actually who you are off stage and on stage. And I think.
But here's the lesson to take from that. If you want that I've taken from that when I'm, you know, as a 65-year-old, everything that has been monumental has been in my own personal career, probably were the hardest. That they're not things that I would have get. You know, I didn't want to be a comedian. That was a dare. I didn't want to be a game show host. That was, we just went through that story. I thought I'd get a sitcom and I got on St. Elsewhere. That was also by accident, but that was one of the great moments in my career. But what I'm realizing is as human beings, the thing that keeps us, and I say this just about everywhere I go because I want people to kind of live by this instead of overthink. I think thinking is a problem. And I think that our instinct is a treasure. And I think if instinctually, if we act on instinct, we will be right. If we think about it, we will stop. You know, even the idea of becoming a comedian or becoming a ventriloquist or whatever, where we come from, you know, that is such a long shot. If you put a lot of thought into whether I should do it or I shouldn't do it, if you're going to think about it, it's going to come out where you shouldn't do it. If you just do it, like Nike says, you will do it and you will have less regrets throughout your life. You know, everybody alive has shoulda, coulda, woulda. And the more you can cut down those shoulda, coulda, wouldas, and that's not with overthinking, that's just with doing, because even if you do and you fail, and I consistently fail each and every week, each and every day at something, those failures are... opportunities of education, or they're the thickening of your skin for the next time you're going down the same path. There's always a glass half full value to failure. And it kind of motivates me to continue playing on. You know, I've learned from the mistakes of my own feelings of wanting to quit and stop. It was a mistake. That was thinking about, you know, that's harboring all the time that we are, you know, kind of metaphorically kicked in the nuts, you know, for, you know, just, you know, it's hard how we, you and I and people like us are rejected. And all we want to do is show up and make people smile. Well, it's amazing how many people say no.
Well, that is one of those things that I harp on and I've tried to teach my kids, is that you are those learning moments are the worst moments in your life. And that's when you get better. And it's how you react in adversity that defines you as a human being. And it also telegraphs whether you're going to succeed or be a miserable whatever. But let me ask you one side question here. Why in the world do ventriloquists do so well on AGT? I think you've had like, what, 82 ventriloquists on there that have won, something like that?
Have won. Because what you guys do, and I know that you've been a part of it too. I know that you were a part of some of our winners and backstage and helping them, you know, and they.
Well,
I
think they're all winning because people think they're me. That's what I think. Don't you think? They think they're never mind.
Well, you know, yes, because there is nobody better. You are the gold standard for all that.
That's it. Of course. Yeah.
But the truth of the matter is, it's still a fascinating. It like combines everything that people love on our show. When it's not a ventriloquist that wins, it's a magician that wins. Or it's a singer that wins, right? And when you look at the ventriloquists that we've had on the show, they've been able to convince. First of all, ventriloquism, for all intents and purposes, is magic. You know, it is magic. There's what is supposedly an inanimate object is not you. You're making that talk to us and speak to us. Then there's stand-up comedy and music and everything. All that. The combination of so many different valuable entertainment types all in one package of ventriloquism is still mesmerizing. Will always be.
Okay, but it still doesn't make any sense because, you know, ventriloquists were even in vaudeville, we were the guys they shoved on stage when they closed the curtain so they could reset the stage for the real acts. You know what I mean?
Well, that's comedians too.
I guess you're right. But I just, it is amazing to me that how many people have, as ventriloquists, have gone on there and done well. I mean,
because I find it's visually fantastic. It's audibly fantastic. It checks so many boxes. So if you're half decent at it, you know, I think that you're amazing at it. And I also love the material. But even some of the people that I've watched on our show, even when the material is not great, and that's what I've told people. I've told some ventriloquists who haven't made it that far, but have moved on. If you have, they have the skill set to do the ventriloquism, but they don't have the material. A lot of people do that with impressionists that come on our show too. I always say, sure. You know, you're checking two out of the three boxes. You know, you've got stage presence,
right?
You've got this skill that you can do. The third box is you got no material,
right?
You know, but still it's enjoyable to watch this character come to life. And I love that. And you're doing it well. And I love you, but you're not saying anything. But the point is that you bring to the table this entire buffet of entertainment as a ventriloquist.
Well, see, you just, that was a perfect example of what you can do on the show. It's like being brutally honest, but serving it up on a platter that they can digest without getting sick and wanting to go kill themselves. I mean, it's
the thing about the love hate that I have with what I do on that show, and mostly it's love, but I hope that the people that decide to come on the show are, you know, prepared. And we have safety nets in place, like there's psychologists backstage if they get devastated. But I would never, first of all, I'm aware that there's always more people, way more people that don't like something than like it. You know, I've also told the story ad nauseum so many times about.
Hold on,
you know,
a second.
Selling.
Wait, say that again. What? There are more people that dislike something than like something.
Always. And this is the analogy that I was going to make is when I popped off in the 80s, you know, somebody said, you want to play Radio City Music Hall? And I said, yeah. And we put it on sale and it sold out in like hours. And then they said, you want to add a second show? And I said, yeah. And it sold out in hours. And, you know, in the 80s, that was a big thing. So that's 14,000 people. And after the first show, I'm in Radio City Music Hall and I'm looking out on 7th Avenue and there's 7,000 people teaming out of the theater from the first show, 7,000 people coming into the second show. There's 15,000 people on the street in New York City on 7th Avenue. There's stanchions set up. There's cops. There's a traffic jam. My wife's looking out. She goes, look, this is all for you. What are you thinking? And I said, I'll be totally honest with you. This is what I'm thinking. This is New York City. in New York City is the city of 10 million people. That means that 9,986,000 people don't give a shit that I'm here.
Okay, I get it now. Wow. Yeah, all
but
right.
But I realize that, you know, my opinion is just my opinion. But I try to give it to you constructively. Sure. Not everybody's going to, especially in humor, not everybody's going to get it. But I will respect you for showing up. I will respect, you know, I believe that humor, the fact that you and I are able to share our humor is also not only skill, but a lot of luck. And I'll tell you what it is, because your humor is inherent to who you are. And I used to go to the Comedy Store, like on Monday nights, they'd go, I would get up on stage, but it's an amateur night, right?
Right.
And you would think, and people talk about amateur comedians getting on and dying. And I don't know how many nights you've been there where you see and they go, it's so painful. Like, why do these people even think they're funny or they would have a career? And my contention is nobody is on that stage under their own fruition. They've all sat
right
at a Thanksgiving dinner and, you know, Uncle Milt said, you know, you're so funny the way you do your aunt's voice. And you should be a comedian. You should try out. So they show up. You know, I didn't have a friend in the world, but whatever I did or whoever I was, luckily that sensibility clicked with a larger amount of people than sit at my dinner table.
Right.
You know, and right, we're just lucky that our sensibility and our sense of humor is something that is shared. Because it doesn't mean that they're any less funny. It's just that less people see the funny in what they're seeing the funny in.
Right. Well, I
forget what the question was.
Well, last thing here. I don't want to put you on the spot here, but you are known for amazing practical jokes.
Right.
So is there, and you do them not only on camera, but you do them in person. So is there, there's two things I want to talk about here before that. And I want to know the absolute worst time you died on stage. So is there a good practical joke and is there a good time you died on stage? You can tell us.
Yeah. And they're kind of similar.
Okay.
So the practical jokes I like, I think we spoke about this and I've also talked about this. My favorite comedy, real, like the gut-wrenching comedy, is real. You know, my family in my house, my parents loved comedy. I have no recollection of any time that they weren't buying albums or watching The Tonight Show or Ed Sullivan and watching comedians. And as a little boy, I used to hear the laughter in the living room and run into the living room and I'd see what they were watching. And I was so little that I had no, I wanted to be part of this party and part of this laughter, but I had no point of reference. So if there was a comedian on Merv Griffin and they were laughing and he was making mother-in-law jokes, I didn't even know what the hell a mother-in-law was.
Right.
But I saw my parents laughing. The first recollection I have of being invited to the party of laughter was maybe 4 or 5 years old. It's a Sunday night. We're watching the Alan Funt's Candid Camera. And on Alan Funt's Candid Camera, he explains to us that he's going to pretend he's the boss of an office. He's going to hire these receptionists. He's going to tell them that it's imperative that they answer the phone whenever it rings. Do not miss one phone call. Then he shows us, the audience, that he's attached the leg of a desk to a rope that goes through a wall. And when the girl goes to reach for the phone, they're going to pull the rope and the desk is going to go away and she's going to be... And you see, you're laughing even before you see it. And that's how I was, you know, and I felt like this is the first time he kind of explained to me, I'm 4 years old. I understand. I turned to my parents. We're all sitting there in that anticipatory fun time, like when you're throwing a surprise party for somebody and everybody's hiding behind the couch and they go, she's coming up the driveway. She's coming up the driveway. So we all knew. And then what happened is she sits down at the desk, the phone rings, she goes to reach it, the desk slides away. She's like just horrified. And we laughed. It was a guttural laugh that I'll never forget that feeling. It, you know, and I couldn't stop laughing and I was crying. And from that day forward, I have spent my life trying to recapture that moment. And at 4 and 5 years old, I had no thought process in as far as I don't have a TV show. I don't have an audience. I don't even have a friend to tell, watch me go over there and do that. So I started doing these things that I here's what I understood. I understood that if I set them up, people would, I love the idea that I was manipulating people's reactions, but not, I wasn't getting the laugh, you know, even when I got older and I talked about it many times, you know, I wanted to get out of swimming in high school. And so I threw, it became, it ended up in meatballs or, but I threw a chocolate bar into the pool, you know, and
you mean like
I didn't tell anybody.
Just like in Caddyshack,
uh-huh, you know, and, uh-huh. And but if you go look way before Caddyshack came out in 1979, watch me on Make Me Laugh. And I'm talking because I didn't have an act yet and they hired me on Make Me Laugh. And I talked about doing that.
Right.
And that was 4 years before the movie.
Oh.
But anyway, so 1979 is when I talked about it on TV. But anyway, I did it. I didn't tell anybody I did it. So it wasn't like a bunch of friends, let's go to the pool and see. I saw that there was an announcement. If anybody has any information of who might have defecated in the pool, there'll be no ramifications. Just tell us. I go down to the pool area, you know, 500 people, not my friends, are standing there going, oh my God, disgusting. Look at the shit at the bottom of the pool. And without even thinking, you know, I dived in and came up with it in my mouth. Now, that's a funny recollection of the story.
Right.
500 people unanimously were so disgusted with me, wouldn't talk to me, would just think I was an idiot, would roll their eyes. I didn't get a girlfriend. I didn't have a date. I was asked to leave the school. Like everything was just, it wasn't, now I tell the story or people who went to that school goes, I'll never forget that time. Well, you weren't my friend. You didn't tell me it was funny.
And how old were you? How old were you?
That was probably at about 15, 16.
That's the best.
But I did that stuff all the time. And they're funny stories now. They're not, they weren't, they were almost traumatizing because I didn't have any friends. I was asked, I don't have a GED. I was thrown out of three different schools.
Well, tell us, I don't know if it's true, but tell us the story about how you got kicked out of high school, the big one, which to me was just genius.
There was all these. I've got a million of those, but one story, I think maybe the one that you're referring to is the, I still, to this day, do prank calls.
Right.
I'm doing them on I'm doing a podcast too, and it's me and my daughter. It's Howie Mandel does stuff. It's me. I'll talk about that later. But it's all this stuff. I'm doing prank calls now.
Are there episodes on now? Are there episodes on now?
Not yet.
Okay. All right.
Not yet. It'll be out next month in April.
All right.
But it's me and my daughter, and I do prank calls and challenges and talk to friends. It's just bizarre. It's all the things that I do that kind of keep me going. But I called out of the Yellow Pages. I was just in the Yellow Pages. We were in the house, and I saw a construction company. So I called the construction company. I don't think of where this is leading, but I called and they said, you know, so-and-so construction. I said, yes, my name's Howie Mandel. I didn't even change my voice. I found that authenticity works not only in my career, but in all that. Like if you don't try too hard, people don't smell you trying too hard, right?
Right.
So I go, my name's Howie Mandel and I'm calling about this school. We're interested in adding an addition onto the library. About 4 feet onto the 40 feet into the western field, and I would love to get a if I can get a quote on that. Can you tell me when you'll be there? I kind of knew that I took math class, you know, at 3:10 or 2:10 or whatever,
right.
And math class overlooked on that field. So I said, if you can be there between 2:10 and 2:40, you know, that would be great. Just measure and give me a. So now I'm sitting in math class and I see a guy in the field with tape measure and things like that. He's got a little tool belt and he's doing all this. Then I see, and everybody's sitting in math. I didn't even tell I didn't have a friend. And then I look and I see the vice principal walking out to the field and talking to the guy. And I see him, I just see gestures. And it's just, I'm just giggling in class. And they go, what are you giggling? The teacher stops me, Howard? I go, nothing, I'm sorry. And I can't say, look on the field, and I didn't tell anybody. It's funny. Within 5 minutes, I hear, will Howard Mandel please come down to the office? And they brought me down to the office, and I'm alone. There's nobody, there's no audience. And he says, did you hire a company to put an addition onto the library? And I said, no. And he goes, well, I just spoke to a gentleman out in the field that said, you hired him. He gave us your name. And I go, well, you misinterpreted. I am getting three estimates that nobody has hired. And he goes, just sit down. Like he's mad. And he called my parents, and my parents came in, and he reiterated the whole thing to them. And I saw them were trying to be good parents. They're biting their lip, trying not to laugh. But anyway, I was asked to leave the school, and I left the school. But these kind of events followed me my whole life, even to my first, you know, my reputation preceded me. On my first date with Terry, with my wife,
right?
I borrowed my mother's car. And it was a Cutlass Supreme, right? Convertible. So cool. And you know, I grew up in Toronto, and finally she said, okay, she'll go out with me. And she dated me, and I turned a corner. It was in the winter, and I made a left turn, and I hit an ice patch. Mm-hmm. And that car went into a 360. We started spinning, and I was going too fast anyway. I was like not a good driver. I'm still a horrible driver. But the car was spinning, and then on the driver's side, we hit the center island. We hit the curb with the two wheels, and the passenger side, it went up on the side. It was just about to tip over onto the roof, but it swung back and landed on the wheels. Right. And I was like almost, I was beside myself. And Terry turns to me, my wife, and she looks at me and she goes, very funny. Go, are you kidding me? We almost died. She goes, I know you with your crazy jokes. I go, you think I would flip my mother's car upside down?
Wow.
So like nobody thought of me as funny as much as just crazy.
Wow. That's fantastic. Well, I got to say, Howie, I you know, look, again, going through all the stuff about you and wondering what we were going to talk about, we could go on forever here. I just I love talking to you. I love hearing from you. I just look forward to what's going to happen, because you don't look like a guy who has any intention of taking a vacation or quitting. It's just like you say, it's always what's next, right?
Yes, I just always say yes to everything. And right. What's next for me is my my podcast, available wherever podcasts. You can subscribe on all my socials now. You can go into the bio and hit it and subscribe, and we will notify you.
And the TikTok is just nuts, and you were not kidnapped, which just killed me. That was the big rumor going to people.
Thank you for telling everybody. Don't worry about me. I'm fine. I'm not fine, but I'm okay with this.
But by the way, now, we live fairly close to each other. And
yes.
We drive by every once in a while, and I finally figured out why this seems so familiar to me. When I was a kid, we had our grade school, you know, book, and I still have it. It's everybody's address and phone number, right? And I would find a girl that I thought was cute, and I would get on my bike and ride by their house. And if I thought she was really cute, I would do that, you know, a lot. Like every couple of days, I'd drive by her house hoping to see her. I realize that's what I've been doing with you. I drive by your house hoping I'll see you.
Oh, my God. So, Jeff, what you're saying is you think I'm cute.
I do. I think you're really cute, Howie.
Oh, my God. Thank you. Jeff. I think you're adorable, too.
Oh, thanks for flirting. Yeah. All right. Well, anyway, Howie, this has just been amazing to be able to talk to you like this, you know, being one of the top comedians and television personalities on the planet. This has just been an honor. And thank you for welcoming us into your house. And, you know, tell Terry we said hi. You know, my wife really enjoyed meeting her when we did that thing at Thousand Oaks.
And when this is all over, let's get together in person again and spend some quality time.
Well, I'll just drive by.
Okay. And I'll be in the window looking gorgeous.
I got to tell you one last thing. When we did this the last time, I texted you. I said, we're driving by, open the window and say hi. And you didn't respond. You responded way later, like 2 hours later. But as we were driving by, Audrey looks up and she goes, look, that window's open. You think he's going to wave? I go, nah, I don't think so.
I didn't see it until 2 hours later. I don't always have my phone unless I'm doing a podcast like this. I don't carry my phone around the house.
Well, I look forward to seeing the podcast because I know it's going to be crazy fun. Some of my favorite stuff, and Audrey's as well, was watching you with Leno doing the hidden camera. I mean, it's just geniusly funny. So
I'm doing this podcast with my daughter, Jacqueline Schultz. So it's her and me.
That's great.
Together, just having a good time. Yeah. All right, buddy.
All right, my friend. Thank
you. Stay healthy.
All right. You too.
Bye.
Bye. All right, so there we go. That was our chat with Howie Mandel. I loved it. Good. Yeah, Peanuts, good to see you. Good to see you too, right? Yeah. Did you guys enjoy the interview as well?
It was great. That was really good.
He's got some really cool stories.
Yes. Yes, he does. Funny land. Mm-hmm. And Peanut, do you know why you're here for our, what are we calling these? The character clips at the end of the interviews? Is that what we're calling them?
I think you just named it. Character clips.
Character clips. Yes. No, I don't know why I'm here. Well, the only parallel between you and Howie that I could think of was your hair. What? He doesn't have a green, lovely tuft like I do here. No, he's bald like this. Perfect. So you look a little like Howie Mandel.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Oh, no, look at Jeff. Roth Pan.
That's
We're
nice.
A mess.
And for the folks who are listening to the podcast, trust us. I am bald, and now Jeff Rothpan is bald as well.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
It's just starting to thin.
Wow. All right. So here we go. Peanut, you're on stage.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite bits. It's a classic bit that goes back in our act for a long, long time. Right. Yep.
It kind of started everything for you.
Not everything. No, they didn't need it big.
Right. Yeah. Here we go.
How you doing, Peanut? Doing pretty good. How about you? I'm fine. That's good. That's good. That's good. So you like it here? Oh, I love being in D.C. D.C. It's great. And I love this theater, the Warner Theater. It's fantastic. They have the cool website, right? They got a link to our website, which is jeffdunham.com. And I think that, hold it. I think that, Peanut, stop me. What's the day? What's the day? What? What the hell is wrong with you? We cannot talk at the same time. I talk, you talk, I talk, you talk. That's it. Focus. I am so sick of this crap. I have tried going solo. What happened? Kept falling off this freaking thing, and I just... Why did you interrupt me? You mispronounced my name. What, you mispronounced my last name? I know! It's Dunham. Now, when you look at it, it says Dunham, just Dunham. Ham. You're the other white meat.
All right, Peanut, that was pretty good.
It wasn't pretty good. It was fantastic. There's no doubt about it. I am the comedic genius, I guess. Okay, great. Yeah.
Thanks for joining us, everybody. Be sure and tune in next week for our next podcast, where
Apple Podcasts, Spotify, your favorite podcast provider, whatever you want.
Right, yeah. You can also watch us on YouTube.
Oh, good. Or on Facebook. Subscribe, like, comment, hit the notifications. Isn't there a bell or something?
There is.
Okay, do that. It'll be great. Fantastic.
Thanks for joining us, everybody.
See ya and hear ya next time.